Well, hello. I am here and just happy as I can be to see all of you here. I'm always quite stunned I'm quite stunned about the technology and the opportunity it provides us, and it's just wonderful. Just magnificent. So I'm really happy to be here with you, and I'm happy that you are here with me. I have just one very short email to read today, and I'm reading it because I'm reading it because I am. Hi, John. I am just listening to your talk where you talk about the life being the investigation. The life being the realization of reality. I don't get it. I thought the point was to see you have no stake in the life. Can you talk about this some more? Thanks so much. Yeah, it's certainly the case that the things that I say can seem confusing and contradictory and puzzling and so forth, and it's not my intention that that be the case, but here's the deal. The only thing I say that you really need to pay attention to, really, this is all there is, and this is all that you really need to pay attention to, is this. Look at yourself whenever you can. That's the long and short of it, the whole of it. There's nothing more really that needs to be heard. There's nothing more really that needs to be done apart from making an earnest and sincere and effective effort to look at yourself. Now, I actually try to choose what I say pretty carefully, because there is just about nothing I can say that actually accurately conveys and communicates what it is I want to convey and communicate to you. So that when I say look at yourself, make an earnest effort to look at yourself, I don't mean to find yourself. I don't mean to understand yourself. I don't mean to find your real self or anything like that. I mean exactly that. Make a sincere and earnest effort to look at yourself. Now, the difficulty arises, part of the reason that difficulty arises in hearing and responding to this instruction is because the truth is that you are always and forever seeing yourself. There has never been a moment in life, not a moment in time, not a nanosecond in sleep or wakefulness, that you are not seeing yourself. So what I am asking you to do is to look at that which is the only thing that you are always, without fail, already seeing. Everything else, and if you will try, you will succeed. It is the earnest effort that counts. It is the earnest attempt to look at yourself that counts. It's even an attempt to see yourself, but that's even a little too much, because I don't care whether you see yourself or not, since you are already always seeing yourself. I care that you consciously try to direct your attention to bring it in direct contact with the reality of what you are, which is ever-present, which never moves, never changes, which is simple beyond all possibility of being described. You, just you. Look at you. Everything else I say, and I have to say that looking back, the thread of me asking you to try to look at yourself has been the same from the very beginning of my involvement in this order. The rest of what I say changes all the time. The rest of what I say that is meant to be in support or in support of the instruction to look at yourself changes all the time. The rest of what I say is an attempt to develop a narrative that makes sense, that is not untrue, and that provides encouragement and confirmation about what you're doing, about the reason why you would want to do this, about what the effects of the long-term effects of engaging in this practice might be or might look like. And since well, that's the reason I say everything else I say. Encouragement and confirmation. A narrative that gives you a sense of why this works or why it doesn't work. None of the rest of that is true in any sense of, in any absolute sense. Nothing that we speak about in the world is true in any absolute sense. It's true provisionally, it's true relative to other possibilities of speaking about it, so forth. It may be effective, it may be useful, it may be good to listen to or irritating to listen to. It may have all those characteristics, but the one characteristic it doesn't have, all the rest that I say, is absolute truth. It's provisional. It's conditional. What I have seen and this aspect of what I do has changed actually quite a bit in the 10 years that I have been in this very strange role, as it should. You know, we're not talking about something here that is like God, or, that is like God, about which nothing ever changes. I'm speaking now of my expression, my effort to communicate and convey things. It's not something that never changes. It's not dealing with anything that never changes. It's dealing with a story. It's dealing with a point of view. And it's dealing with my earnest desire to persuade everybody that I can possibly get to, talk to, everybody's ear into which I can possibly enter, to persuade everybody to try this, to try just looking at yourself. Whether you try it because it is recommended by me, or it is recommended by Ramana, or the story that I tell is persuasive and convincing, or just you try it because you try it. The reason that you try it is beside the point. I want everybody to try it because it is my gathering experience. This is an experience that is being reconfirmed newly every day with reports that I hear from you guys, all of you. It is obvious to me from your reports and from my own experience that anybody who actually tries this cannot fail. They may feel like they're failing for a time. It may get very confusing. It may get very dramatically agitated. But in the end, the outcome is always the same, which is a snuffing out of the need to search for some solution to some imagined problem that I think might be the nature of my thoughts or the nature of my desires or my sinfulness or my inability to concentrate or anything like that. An end to the need, this driving urge to find a solution to the problem of life. an end to the need to find some way to make myself safe in this life, to make myself secure in this life, to make myself what I need to be in order to prevail in this life, to find a definition of myself that works and is stable. All of that ends. All of that is snuffed out. For some, quite quickly. For others, it may take years. But your reports are, make it plain that no one can fail once they try, just try this, try to look at themselves. Now I have a storyline as to why that would be so. And that storyline is that, first of all, from birth, from the moment of the birth of individual consciousness, of the individual sense of self, prior to any idea of what consciousness is, prior to any idea of what I am, prior to any idea of what's going on, prior to any idea even of existence, prior to any words, prior to any understanding, at that moment, when there first appears me, which I don't even know to be me, immersed in a maelstrom of sensation and color and movement and hunger and thirst and wanting and getting and not getting and satisfaction and dissatisfaction, none of which I know anything about except that it's this wild, chaotic maelstrom of experience. And in that moment, there arises for all, there arises a belief that I am in danger here, that I am at stake here, that there is something very important that I must do in order to keep myself safe, that I must deploy ideas of myself that work. In other words, I must, if it is hunger that I need to satisfy, I must deploy the strategies and tactics necessary to satisfy that hunger, which may, in the case of the infant, be screaming at the top of its lungs until its mother comes and feeds it. Throughout life, I am driven by the same desperate need to protect myself from the danger of life, the same desperate need to become something by taking on characteristics and habits and actions and opinions and relationships and the like that are suitable. I must find some way to become something that is safe and secure and not at risk in this life, not subject to the danger of the things that life can throw at me. I see my life as being a problem. I see that if I can fix certain characteristics of my life, maybe those problems will be resolved. I see my thoughts as being a problem. I see my desires as being a problem. I see my emotions as being a problem. I see all of the rising and falling, shifting and changing kaleidoscope of sensual experience as being a hugely dangerous world in which I must learn to live and to protect myself. And maybe, although unlikely, maybe even get a taste of what seems to be life's promise at the end. So I work hard for my whole life long, ever, always alert, always holding life at arm's length, always holding the mind itself at arm's length, always skeptical, always suspicious, always fearful, always anxious, always driven by an underlying existential anxiety and the fear of extinction, not knowing from whence the the blow of extinction might come, whether it might come from some wrong thought, whether it might come from some wrong look, from some wrong opinion about things, from some mistake. But always, always driven by this need to become something that can cope with and protect itself from the dangers of life. All driven by this absolutely unseen and unseeable inference, this belief that I am vulnerable here, that I am at stake here, that I am in danger here, that I have to protect myself here, that I have to find some way to get out of this alive, knowing I can't. And that's what I mean by having a stake in the life. Not having a stake in the life, by being at stake in the life, by being on the line in the life, trapped, bound, held, threatened by everything. And this belief, since it arises simultaneous with me, this belief is not even seen to be there. There's no way to find a belief and say, oh, right, that's it, and I talk my way out of it. The very act of trying to talk my way out of the belief, even if I come to believe that it is a belief, if you follow that, the very act of trying to talk my way out of it or understand my way out of it or find new experiences to transcend it, that very act happens within the very structure created by the belief by which I try to find an identity, a thing to be that is safe, that has made the adjustments necessary to not be threatened anymore, to not be at stake anymore. So that even if this possibility that I am at the mercy of this false belief, even if this comes to me and even if I believe it to be true, there's absolutely nothing I can do about it through understanding or changing the way the life is or changing thought or changing desires or changing relationships or changing anything. Since all of those things are driven by the belief itself that I am trying to rid myself of. Now, this, of course, is metaphorical. It is, so far as I can tell, from the things that I have read and from the things that I have heard and from my own experience in this life, so far as I can tell, it is to my taste, to my ears, closer to the bone than most of the other narratives that have been deployed trying to teach us how to be happy, how to be realized, how to be safe in our lives. It seems to me to be much closer to reality, much closer to the actuality of it, but it is not the actuality of it, you see. It's just a narrative. It's just a story I'm telling that may ring true because it is very close to true, but it is not itself the actuality of things. It has no purpose. I have no purpose in telling it apart from to give you the encouragement and the reason for it. Trying what I really want you to try, which is to try to look at yourself as often as you can, when it occurs to you to do so. To not concern yourself about the things that you are doing within your life to make it better or to make you better or to make you safer or to make you have deeper understanding or to make you self-realized or any of the rest of it. Not to pay any attention to any of that in this context. Not to try to stop it. Not to try to change it, not to try to do any, not even to try to stop it. All I want from you is that you try to look at yourself. Because I know that if you try to look at yourself, you will prevail. In the end, everything will come out right. I know this. This is certain. So the narratives that I, the stories that I tell and the things that I say, although if they ring true, it's because they have some of this fragrance of truth in them. But it's not for you to understand. I don't tell you these things in order that in the understanding of these things you will find freedom. There's no freedom to be found. I don't tell you these things in the hope that if you can understand them and if you can in some way incorporate them into your understanding of yourself and the world, that you will then be Buddha mind or be free from the need to be Buddha mind. I tell you these things to try to get you to look at yourself. Really. And to try to show you that there actually is a reason for doing this that is comprehensible to your mind, although what you are doing is not, and the effect of it is not, that the reason for doing it is comprehensible. I tell other stories, too. I tell other narrative threads, too. All still for the same purpose, except that the story that I tell about the false belief of being a stake in the life, which is true enough, the purpose of that is to provide you with a rational and reasonable, because I don't have anything against reason and rationality, to provide you with a rational and reasonable explanation for you to use to yourself for why you're doing what you're doing when you're trying to look at yourself. Some of the other stories I tell are reports from the field, you might say, are approximate efforts to convey and communicate to you what you might expect in the long term from the effort to look at yourself. And this, of course, these stories are, or the telling of stories for this purpose has been staple, a mainstay of spiritual utterance from the very beginning. The sutras, the shastras, the Upanishads, the songs, the hymns, the mantras, the all of it. The stories of gods, the stories of goddesses, the stories of devas and avatars, all of it. Designed to give you a taste, a kind of a bait. It's a bait. And actually it's all bait and switch, I might add. But it's a bait that's dangled to give you the encouragement and the energy to persist in the face of what seems to be nothing happening. And I do the same thing, only I don't talk about gods and goddesses and avatars and enlightenment and transcendence and lightning bolts or resurrection or any of that. I talk about my own experience ineptly. I don't do it very well. I used to not do it at all. But I talk about my own experience in order to give you some sense of what you might expect. And one of the things in my own experience, as best as I can say it, is that the self-realization that we seek in spiritual action, the wonder, the magnificent realization of self, the magnificent realization of eternal awareness in me, the magnificence that I sought in spiritual work and spiritual understanding and spiritual practices, that realization, that awakeness, that enlightenment, that is this life. Always has been this life. That the actual unfolding and ramification and development and evolution, endless movement and change and colors and sensations and hunger and thirst and satisfaction and clarity and confusion and aggression and love and compassion and indifference and resistance and welcoming and attachment and non-attachment, that the whole bucket of movement and display, phenomenal arising, passing away in time, over time, that this life, just as it is, actually is that fundamental realization of eternal awareness that we came to the spiritual arena to find. So I tell you on the one hand that the reason that you cannot see this to be the case is because of the power of this unseen and unseeable belief that you're in danger here. And the case that you and I and no one else who has not rid themselves of that belief, the case that is the case, is that the spiritual awakening that we seek is here as this life. That the realization of awareness, enlightenment of all of it, is here as this life. I also speak about the fact that while we are afflicted with the idea that we're in danger here, that we're at stake here, and so forth, while we remain afflicted with that idea, that belief, we, of necessity, must hold the life itself at arm's length. We must keep our distance. We must have the time that we imagine we need to react to changing circumstances, to a new stupid thought arising, or a new stupid understanding arising, or a new insight arising that will clear everything up. We have to keep it all at arm's length. We have to maintain this illusion of me and my life. That's why I call it my life. That's why I call it my mind. That's why I call it my body, my heart, my everything. It's not me, it's mine. That's how that terminology came to be universally used in human expression. My life, my mind, my thoughts, my desires, my body, my heart, my brain, my feet. Not me, but mine. To keep a close eye on, to be very careful about what thoughts are allowed to remain, to be very careful about what desires are satisfied and what desires are vilified. Keep your life at arm's length. Keep separation, the idea of separation from the life, alive, to protect myself. To keep it from sneaking up on me. And I tell you that in my experience, the snuffing out of that belief, the eradication of that false belief about me in danger and about the life being the danger that I fear so greatly, when that belief is gone, whether it takes 15 minutes of the vichara or 15 years of the vichara, when that belief is gone, all separation from the life goes with it. And the life is indistinguishable from you, as it has always been. So I tell those stories, which aren't really exactly the case. They're the case of the reality of existence is far more complicated, and the reality of existence is extremely complicated. It's complicated. It is the context that forms it, and the context is everything that happens in the entirety of creation from the beginning of time. The reality of you is uncomplicated, is simple. I can't speak about the reality of what you are, because it is far too simple to, for any word to stick to it, for any understanding to stick to it, for any insight to stick to it. It is you. You. And I can't speak intelligently about the nature of existence because the nature of existence is way too complicated to talk about. There's no way in the world that anything can be said about the experience of existence in the absence of the false belief that can possibly contain the hugeness of it. So I tell stories. I do the best I can. And sometimes one story seems to be in contradiction to another story. But I do the best I can. And I have to say I'm getting better at it over time. I'm getting simpler at it over time. But still, the limitation that's imposed by my own, the personal history of John Sherman, his education, his vocabulary, the people he has been with, the circumstances he has been in, and just the limitations of his body and so forth, make it impossible for me to make much headway in actually making a good presentation of what I see. What I see clearly. What I say, I'm not so much. But I tell you this. I tell you this from the part of my heart. If you will, and if I can help convince you by telling you that you suffer from a false belief that will be eradicated by doing this, then I will tell you that because it's true enough. If you will earnestly try, and this is something that is a solitary act. No one can do it for you. No one even, not even I, not even God itself can tell you what you are, how to see yourself, what's meant when I say look at yourself. But if you will, using your own natural native intelligence and common sense, the powers of discernment, if you will, try with all of your heart to look at yourself, you cannot be denied. You cannot fail. You know really what I'm talking about when I say you. You know it. You're here. You're never absent. You never change. You are solid. You are ordinary. You are here, always the same, never changing. And my prayer is that you will try to look at that you are. And I promise you that if you will try to do this, in the end, everything that you ever thought you wanted from spiritual aspiration and spiritual effort will be yours. But that's because that is already the case. Already the case. I promise you that if you will try this, this undercurrent of neurotic existential terror and fearfulness and anxiety and angst, this whole complex of relationship to your life will vanish. The misery that arises from that complex will vanish. I promise you that. Another story I tell is that, and this too is not true in any strict sense, but it's true enough, is that this practice, this activity, which is called self-inquiry, or is called the vichara, after the usage of Ramana Maharshi, and which I really like calling into vichara. I've gotten kind of in love with that. That this vichara, this effort to see yourself, this movement from fruitless efforts at self-definition to the endless adventure of self-discovery, you will see that this vichara is, always has been, has never ever not been, the entirety of creation. The whole of creation, all of the worlds and ideas and fantasies and realities and experiences and thoughts and sensations and relationships and crying cats and suns and stars and moons that from time to time pass through your consciousness, all of creation is the vichara. It is the single act of reality. It is the only urge of eternal awareness to see itself, to discover itself. So that the personal, limited movement of self-inquiry is actually the moving into alignment with the force of creation. It is the moving into alignment with the force of life. It is the moving into alignment with the only activity in all of reality, which is self-discovery, which is self-seeing. And if you start this, if you begin this truly, really not trying to find out what you are, not trying to understand what you are, not trying to become something new or get rid of something old, but just the simple desire to see yourself, to look at yourself as often as you can. If you try this, if you start it, the other thing that you can depend upon is that it will continue. I tell people and I tell everybody here, do this whenever you can. Do this whenever it occurs to you to do so. Do this sitting on your cushion if it occurs to you to do so. Do this standing in the checkout line at the supermarket if it occurs to you to do so. Do this while you're brushing your teeth, if it occurs to you to do so. Don't worry about the times you don't do it. Just do it when you can. Do it when you think of it. And I tell you that the fact of you thinking of it is the apparatus whereby the vichara is taking over and doing itself. But that's all for you to see. And all of this talk has no function or purpose whatsoever except to serve my own desire to have you try this. Now, it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to give up anything. You don't have to learn anything. You don't have to abandon anything you understand. You don't have to stop your mind. You don't have to stop your desires. You don't have to worry about any of that at all. All you have to do is whenever you think about it, make the effort to get just the slightest direct taste of you. And all will be well. So I'm going to stop talking now and feel free to raise your hand or whatever you have to do to talk to me or not. We can just sit here and be together. But I'd love to talk to you, so let me know.
We have Ronnie in Montreal. Ronnie?
Hi, Ronnie. Don't hear you. No voice. Of course, I can't even make a suggestion because I have no idea what might be the problem. But keep working. Are you sure you're not muted or anything like that? Keep trying with the self-test, and if you succeed, come back, okay? I don't know if anybody else is waiting, but I see someone is, so please keep trying. I'd love to talk to you.
Rose, it's your turn now.
Hi, Rose.
Thank you. Hi, John. Hi, Carla. Hi, everyone. I had a question. Is looking for the self is the same, is that the same as looking for awareness, what is aware?
Well, yeah, kind of, except not, because it's not really looking for the self, and it's not really looking for awareness. To speak of the self and to speak of awareness are just two different attempts to speak about the same thing. And what I found is that thinking that the similarity of those two things, or even the distinction between those two things, is of any consequence is just a distraction. You see, what it is that you're looking for or looking at is you. Just you. And it is actually, although it may seem to be not so, and I understand that, it is actually much simpler to see what it is I'm asking of you if you try to look at you rather than self or awareness or anything else. Do you follow that?
Yes. The reason I asked the question was I heard of this thing where you're supposed to just sit even for hours and just try to, you know, look at awareness. Do you think there would be benefit in just sitting for hours and trying to look for self?
Well, there's certainly worse things that you could do. I mean, you know, like jumping off of cliffs or things like that. You see, if you're sitting there for hours and looking for self or looking for awareness, it is pretty much indisputable that you will, during those hours of sitting there, from time to time get a glimpse of yourself, a direct glimpse of yourself. I mean, you always see yourself, but from time to time you'll get a direct glimpse of it. Just as if you are watching television or mowing a lawn or doing any of the other activities that make up the things we do with our time, there will be times when you, and especially if you're involved in the vichara, there will be times when you find yourself getting a direct hit, a little taste of the reality of you, the simple, so simple reality of you. So what I'm saying is that I don't see that sitting looking for awareness is fundamentally any of any more value than mowing the lawn. The thing that is of value is the moments when you to make the effort to see you, just you. And you see, you are not awareness. Awareness, you are not even you. You and awareness and whatever the other thing was, self, these are all words. These are all names that are applied to you. They're not things in themselves. There's no such thing as awareness. There's no such thing as self. There's no such thing as you. But there is you. And you are here. And you are always here. And whatever you are doing with yourself in the meantime, if you stop for a second during that activity, whether it's sitting on a cushion or mowing the lawn, and see if you can't look at yourself, everything will come out right. Do you follow that?
Sort of. Yes. I mean, I hear you and I thank you. I will continue to do that.
I'm sure in my heart that you will, Rose. I have no doubt about that. And, you know, the only thing I'm saying is that even this business of, and I'm not talking to you necessarily personally, Rose. I don't really think this has, this is your, what you do. But, even sitting on the cushion with the intention of looking at self or seeing self or seeing awareness or even with the intention of cultivating, you know, there are a lot of cultivation practices that cultivate compassion and forbearance and the other wonderful truthfulness and the other wonderful aspects of enlightenment and realization and so forth. Even doing those things, even doing the cultivation exercises, even sitting there looking at awareness, or for that matter, mowing your lawn, because, you know, the reason you mow your lawn is in order to be in compliance with what we imagine is the definition of self that will have an easier time in the world. The cultivation of enlightenment characteristics is the effort to define self in a way that will bring me enlightenment and an end to suffering. And the attempt to see awareness or to see self or to see God is all still part of that same effort to develop a self-definition that works and that will bring me what I'm looking for and get rid of what I'm not looking for. So that all of those activities are kind of in everything that's done. Spiritual, religious, mundane, trying to get money, trying to get rid of money, being good, being bad, robbing banks, working in banks. Oh, everything. Underneath of it is this murmuring that is directing the action of self-definition. Of the work of self-definition. Now, the fact is that none of that can hurt you. The work on self-definition isn't hurting you any. It's not doing any damage to you whatsoever. The fear that you will be damaged if you don't get together appropriate definition, that's not hurting you either. That's not doing you any damage either. The misunderstanding, the stupidity with which we describe ourselves and understand our relationships and so forth, they don't hurt you at all. They don't damage you at all. They don't help you either. So the whole range of human behavior, whether it's spiritual behavior, religious behavior, or mundane behavior, or any other behavior, the whole range of human behavior has two faces. In the absence of the misery and suffering and fearfulness and anxiety that arise from this despicable belief that the face is the face of the actual realization of eternal reality or eternal awareness or eternal self or whatever other name you might want to use for it. In the presence of that belief in the presence of that driving need to do the right thing, to be the right thing, in the presence of it, then the whole array of human activity is the mechanism of misery and suffering and heartache and destruction. The only thing that steps outside of that, the only action that is outside of that, and it may even be driven by it in a sense, is the action that seeks actually to look at yourself. And that can happen in the midst of any other activity, whether it's sitting on a cushion or any other thing that's being done. So, I don't ask anybody to abandon anything they're doing. I don't ask anybody to abandon anything they believe. I don't ask anybody to take on any new beliefs. I ask only one thing, and that is to See if you can't look at yourself. So the question about the usefulness of these things, when I hear questions like that, I just, well, it can't hurt, you know? I mean, really, it can't hurt. You see? Does that make any sense to you?
Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. Anybody else?
Vanky calling from North Carolina.
Hi, Vanky.
Hey, John. I don't know what I really plan to say, but yeah, I have a few thoughts, and hopefully they don't come out in a torrent. The basic thing I want to let you know is that all this crazy searching for solutions has like boiled down into one answer, and it's something that you keep stressing again and again, is that seek to put your attention on the sense of self. And no matter what old questions come up back again, the only one thing, one answer comes back. And this, I don't know, it's not a logical conclusion, but there is a acceptance that, okay, that is what needs to be done, is to place the attention on the sense of self without knowing why. There's no logical reason to do that except that it works.
That's absolutely the case. The really only logical reason to do it is because it works. All of the stuff that I say to try to persuade people to do it isn't the reason to do it. It's just me trying to be an agent of persuasion. The only reason to do it, and the only way you can know this is when you start doing it, is because it works. The thing that sets the vichara apart from every other thing is its practicality. It's pragmatism. It cares not for saints and sinners. It cares not for gods and goddesses. It cares not for anything whatsoever except that it work. It finishes the misery. So that's a good report. I'm happy to hear that.
Also, John, I already kind of guessed what your answer to this is going to be, but I just wanted to put it out there, is that it is no more pleasant to know that it works. I mean, it's no much, it's not a greater relief, or, you know, the moment you realize, oh, this is the only answer to everything, that keep the attention on the sense of self, it doesn't mean that the old fearfulness and anxiety go away. In fact, after reaching this dead end, I call it, knowing that, okay, this is the only thing that will work, the answer, or I don't know what it is, but the searching, the wanting to stop doesn't like happen, you know, like right away. In fact, in my personal experience, the stress and the physical toll that this has taken has been greater once I've reached this dead end. In fact, I find the stress and physical toll to be greater, but also there's the simultaneous recognition that this is the only thing that has worked, and it's kind of ironical, as far as I can see. It's a paradox, actually.
Yes, that's the case. It's and this is one of the things that make the communication and the passing on of this possibility somewhat difficult, because the fact of the matter is that they're most often as the practice is continuing and as the work continues with or without our intent, most often nothing seems to happen, really. I mean, we get into this spiritual game thinking that at some point we're going to find something to do that will be the thing, and that instantly, immediately, without further ado, all confusion will be cleared up, all discomfort will be cleared up, all pain and pleasure, all misunderstanding and the clear light of reality will dawn full and open and without without distortion. And this, of course, is a childish thing. It's a childish idea that we are very fond of, that we can get salvation, some instant salvation from some imagined danger. But the vichara doesn't produce that. The vichara, quite often, it feels like nothing's happening. And also quite often, and it certainly was the case in my own experience, and in the experience of many people that I speak with, it quite often is the case that it seems to actually make things worse for a time. And I suspect that that has to do with I'd tell a story about it, but it has something to do with the weakening of the hold of this underlying reason for doing anything, this underlying feeling of being at risk and in danger. But anyway, it is the case. And it's often the case that it seems to get worse. And it's often the case that it seems to do nothing. But in the end, and the thing that you say that is very, very confirming is just that you keep doing it. That's the main confirming sign of the vichara, is that you keep doing it. There is no payoff. There is no immediate gratification. There is no, nothing changes that doesn't already change. But you keep doing it. And that's the main confirming sign. And in the end, I have to tell you also that it's often the case that that the wonder of life is fully perceived without distortion and without separation, and that reality is in place for some time before you even notice that things have changed. And of course, part of the reason for this is because all we are trying to do is to see what we are already, always, and forever already seeing. All we are trying to do is to know what we already know. All we are trying to do is rid ourselves of the foolish idea that we don't know, that we are small and vulnerable and on the line here. So, right? You get that?
Yes, John. I've heard you say this in a thousand different ways before, and I think the one that struck home closest was your description of the taste of wine. I mean, of course, sometimes I try to mentally trick myself, saying, "Oh, what would it feel like to, you know, for this to finally, you know, come to an end or something like that." But obviously, the greatest thing I think is that it takes away your ability to lie to yourself. And I mean that in terms of a good, positive, healthy skepticism and honesty that comes into you as a result of this process. And the other thing I wanted to comment on is by hearing something you said today, it seems almost as if all the things that we think is the problem, and we start looking for solutions either spiritually or psychologically or any of these, at least they all seem to be not the case, they're not the reason why we got into inquiry seems to be the things that matter, and that reality is something completely unique and apart and integrated apart from these problems that we started off with. And I think that I got a sense of that when we were talking today. And so it's not this me and its worries that are the focus, but the reality of existence that is the focus of things. And this is as far as I can get with my you know, vocabulizing it. Yeah.
Yes, that's very good, and it is the case. You know, the thing you said, and just to further develop this, you said while you were talking just now, you said that sometimes you wonder what it would feel like and so forth, and I'm not quibbling about whether you should wonder that or shouldn't wonder it or whether that's what you meant or whether you didn't mean that. But it's not uncommon. I mean, certainly it was my experience to wonder what it would feel like to be finished with all of this, what it would feel like. And, of course, I wondered it during the time of great spiritual experience and striving and so forth, as much as I wondered it when the hell realm struck me. But here's the deal. What it feels like is just exactly what you feel like right now. What it feels like, all of you, anybody who hears this, is you. It feels exactly how it feels right now. Nothing changes except that which is already changing. Something is gone, but the feeling, and this is why Ramana was so determined to call his state the natural state, because not because that's some kind of a esoteric and very subtle secret thing, but because the natural state is, well, the natural state. It's the state that is always here. It is natural. It's not some new thing. It's not some new broadening of horizons. It's not some new enlightenment or anything. It is what it feels like. It's just like you feel now. Just like that. Exactly like that. Without fear, without this kind of sickly, paranoid claustrophobia, without effort to, without the continuing effort of self-definition as a means of escape or as a means of salvation. So I'm happy to hear from you, Venky. Anything else?
No, John, that's it. Thank you, and I wish you and Carl all the best. Bye.
Well, you're very welcome, and likewise, I wish you all the best as well. You know, this thing about what it feels like to be unbound. It's actually the case that in pretty much all of the spiritual teachings that are really attractive in Buddhism, or at least in Tibetan Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, in the Tao, in aspects of mysticism in the Western religions, there is always this underlying recognition and this underlying claim that after all of our efforts, after all of our heroic efforts in the spiritual realm, in the realm of seeking a spiritual solution, that our efforts, although they might be quite dramatic and quite energetic and quite filled with heroic deeds and heroic adventures and so forth, that in the end, when we are at the end of our journey, when we are at the end of our strivings, we find ourselves exactly where we were when we started. Nothing changed. Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. that particular phrase, all you have to do is take the enlightenment out of it. In Mahayana Buddhism, they speak of the practice as being a ferry boat across the ocean of samsara, from the shore of suffering and the need to find a solution to the far shore of enlightenment and freedom and liberation. And they tell us that upon landing on that far shore, we discover that it is the shore that we departed, not the same kind of shore, not the same kind of experiences and so forth, but the actual shore from which we departed. And these puzzling assertions are to be found everywhere in the spiritual utterance, in the world of spiritual utterance. And I can remember that there was a time when I would read those things and be kind of thrilled by them and think, wow, that's really mystical. That's really, wow, that's heaven. That's deep. That's mysterious, mystical. But it's none of that. It's just the literal truth. Right here, right now, in this moment, nothing changed. Nothing kept from changing. Right now, right here, in this moment, the whole of creation is trying to say something about you. The whole of creation is you seeking to see yourself. The whole of creation is to be charred, realized, is you realized. Right now, nothing changed, nothing added, only one thing taken away. Gives you, clears the vision, gives you the ability to see what you have always been seeing, to feel what you've always been feeling, to realize what you have always been realizing, right now. And the only way to get rid of that which stands in the way of seeing that is to look at yourself. Because the issue is the issue of identity. The issue is the issue of identity, which gives rise to this ever-present choice in every circumstance whatsoever to work at self-definition, which doesn't do anything except cause pain and suffering, or to turn your attention to self-discovery, which is the vichara, which is the effort, the earnest, heartfelt effort to look at yourself. Life doesn't change, except of course it always changes. Pain is still pain, pleasure is still pleasure, fear is still fear, anxiety is still anxiety, beauty is still beauty, horror is still horror. None of that changes. What changes, what's missing, what's absent, is this deep, heartfelt conviction that you are the victim, the subject, the victim of all that. Either the victim of the horror or the victim of the pleasure. And that's what goes. The rest remains as it always has been, as it is now, and as it ever shall be. Okay, anybody want to talk to me?
Rose?
It's Rose again. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Are these talks, I know that you do the monthly sales of the CDs, you know, where you can get one or two a month. They're often your talks in person. Is it easy for you to get these worldwide web transcriptions that you could sell by request or in addition more consistently?
I don't think so, but really you need, this is something you need to talk to Carla about offline. But I think that, you see, here's the thing, right? I really don't want to sell anything. I am happy with whatever little bit of revenue we get from, like, the monthly subscriptions. It's a very useful, really wonderful thing. But really, if I had my way, I wouldn't sell anything. So the only thing we really sell is physical products that require labor and materials and, you know, and all of that stuff. And we provide the subscription program with the CDs as because people have found it useful, people who are not so much into going to the web and playing things on the web or downloading them and so forth. They find those things useful, and we limit those to stuff that is not available on the web. But everything other than those things, as far as, you know, those and DVDs and CDs and things of that nature, books and stuff, everything other than physical product, I want to be freely available and without charge. And the only things that we do charge are things that actually require labor and materials. So, do you follow that?
Yeah, I do. What I often wish is that I had the World Wide Web on some kind of tape or something so I could play it in my car afterwards or not be glued to the computer, because so often they're just so, you know, I mean, they're always amazing, and the questions and your answers are always so helpful.
Well, there's two possibilities. One is that, of course, these are always available on the web, and usually quite quickly, depending upon how much other work Carla has to do. Carla works, I can't even tell you how much work Carla does. But these are usually available pretty quickly, and what you can do is download them and burn them to a CD, or even download them and put them on your iPod or portable player. To record them to a cassette. But that's something you have to do. But they're always there, and they can be downloaded or streamed. They can be copied anywhere. They can be, anything you want to do with them can be done with them. Okay?
Thank you. That is really sweet. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. It's my, the response, the usefulness that these, having these recordings and videos and so forth freely available on the web for anybody to get to anytime they want to download, to listen online, to do that, the response and the usefulness that are reported by people is huge. And it just tickles me that we have the technology and the ability to make this freely available, for, you know, free of charge. And everything costs something, but, you know, these online ones don't cost enough to have to charge to make them available. So, anybody else?
Ronnie calling from Montreal.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hello, John. Hello, John.
There you are. I got you. I hear you.
Cool. Great. Okay, I muted my microphone. Well, what you were talking about today, and of course, it's just always perfect. my question is, yeah, it's the actual, like, my spiritual bubble's been burst, you know, and in one way, I'm totally delighted. It feels right, you know, it feels true to me. And on the other hand, it's bringing up a lot of fear, because this shaky feeling of kind of on my own now, you know, much more than when I was with a spiritual teacher and a guide. And so I was wondering, do you feel this, like you often say, talk about the vichara and how to do it and what to look for, and but at the same time as I go into it, I mean, there's a lot of very shaky moments of fear and seeing horrors, you know, like seeing my, you know, things with children or, you know, being annihilated and the fear of death and all of that, you know, comes up very deeply. And one podcast, I heard you say something about fear, so I'd just like you to maybe talk a little bit about that again, and if you can guide or give me some help with that. Okay, thank you.
I'm glad to hear your spiritual bubble has been burst. It's my endless desire to burst all the spiritual bubbles I can so that we all can live free. And so I'm very happy to hear that. Pertaining to the, it's not uncommon, and it certainly is, I guess my experience with the vichara was not a very smooth one. So the things that you report and the things that other people report about the rising fear and this business about all your favorite children being murdered, and I really get that. I really understand that. I am very familiar with it from my own experience, and I tell you from my heart that it'll pass. It'll pass. It has come, it will go. Anything that comes, goes. It certainly is possible to weave some kind of a spiritual narrative around the effects of the vichara, and the reason why these psychological, kind of hidden psychological characteristics and aspects and complexes are set free or are loosed in the face of the vichara, but that doesn't do much good except to give you something after the fact to talk about or to yourself. You know, but it is the case. There's been this effort that's been going on for all of your life, for all of us, for all of your life, to cobble together some definition of yourself that will hold true and that will protect you from all of the fear, the things that are fearful and threatening and horrifying and so forth in the world. And of course, in order for that to do that, it has to first create the impression that there are fearful and horrifying and awful things that can happen to you if you're not protected by some useful self-definition. That creation of those entities, of those demons and so forth, is just the process of naming unintentional, spontaneous arisings of energetic sensation. And it's easy to see that once the central core, the kind of command center, that is the belief, once that command center finds itself directly threatened by the light of reality, that it would lose some of its capacity to protect you from those things, but some of its capacity to hold on to the definition that has been effective in the past. So there, I've just woven a story that explains why all that stuff happens, and it's not maybe so far from true. It's a good sign. It's not a bad sign. It is a good sign. It's a sign of the effectiveness of the vichara. Now, and it will pass. God knows how long it'll take. I don't. But it will pass, and the vichara will continue. Now, pertaining to fear, fear is the weakest threat that can be deployed within personal consciousness. Fear really what's the word I'm looking for? Fear can be blown away with a puff of breath. Fear is all show and no go. Fear is thin. So that for the practical possibility of doing something about the discomfort of the arising of fear around this the melodrama, the spiritual melodrama that is playing out. Nothing wrong with the spiritual melodrama. I was quite fond of it. But the one thing that can be done about the fear that accompanies it, because it's not comfortable, is to just look at it. Here's what happens if you look at fear. If you look at fear, it disappears. It's gone. It has force in life only when it's not attended to, when it's run from, when it's honored by running from. So, in the end, it can't hurt you, and in the end, it can't do anything to you whatsoever, this fearfulness and this characteristics of the melodrama that's arriving. It can't hurt you or help you or do anything to you. But if you want to try this, just try this. When fear strikes, just look at it and see what happens to it. And then immediately return to the vichara. Immediately return to this earnest effort that has arisen in you to look at yourself. When fear departs, you see what remains unclouded, uncompromised, occluded. For just a moment, what remains is just you. Just the stark, naked reality of you. When fear is gone, when fear vanishes under your gaze. So, what else can I say? Do you follow that? Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, sometimes when I'm so much into this, doing this vichara, and it goes so deep, and sometimes I just lie down and I ask myself that question, what's at stake? It's like the most simple question, and it seems to point right directly to whatever it is in me that's thinking there's some reason, there's something at stake, there's something I'm keeping at arm's length, or I don't want to feel, or don't want to feel the fear, I don't want to look at. So that's been very, very useful. And also I've noticed that from that space, there's this, it's a bit shaky, but there's this feeling of spontaneity and jumping into life and feeling less and less like there's anything at stake, and there's like this naturalness just happens, you know, meeting life and feeling more and more natural, whatever that means, but I know what it means to myself, you know, and so I'm very, very, yeah, great, thank you.
Yeah, me too. I'm very grateful too. I thank you. That's what's expected. And of course, here's the thing. And you don't have to struggle to try to get this. I just want to point it out to you so that when it dawns on you, you say that you'll be able to say, oh yeah, John said that. And that is that. What you describe is this freshness and the naturalness and spontaneity and the beating of life direct, wholeheartedly. What you describe in those terms has actually always been the case. That actually is the nature of your life. That's why it's called natural, because it is the actual nature of things. Spontaneity, fearlessness, open-heartedness, all of that. Okay?
Thank you. Right now I feel just moving through that fear and the shakiness and this feeling of wanting to cry because it's just so wonderful. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Keep in touch. Let me know how you're doing. Anybody else? Okay. That being the case, we can stop a little early, which I'm sure will be welcomed by those of you who are in the middle of the night or in the wee morning hours. There's not much more that I can say that I haven't already said, except that I love you. I love you all. I am your servant and totally the beneficiary of your involvement in this amazing adventure of self-discovery that is the Vichara. We are together in this. I am determined to be useful and available to you and helpful to you in every way. I am determined to learn from you, to become more adept at communicating this really, really great, great good news, which is that anyone needing no merit, needing no history of practice, needing no understanding, needing to rid oneself of no understanding, anyone, by the simple, direct method of looking at themselves, their self, anyone, in any mind, in any human being, can be revealed to that really sweet, natural, spontaneous, open-heartedness of human life. The realization of reality that is human life. That is here now. That has never, ever been missing. That has never been absent. That is you. You. Just you. So thank you. I think Carla has a couple things she would like to talk to you about before you leave. I am going to go do something else. I love you all. Thank you so much for coming, and I'll see you again wherever I get to see you again, here or there or on the online or on the internets. Be well. See you later.